Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. The other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. We could really use the help. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, though, I want to tell you about our new monthly guidebook / workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians, and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your career and your musical life on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from MyMusicMasterclass.com. So if you want to learn more, go to MyMusicMasterclass.com and you'll see the subscribe link in the menu. Click that and you'll be good to go. All right, everyone, we are super psyched today to have Tana Alexa with us. And if you don't know Tana, she's awesome. She's a great solo artist. She also plays with Migration, which is... with her husband, Antonio Sanchez, who you may have heard of as well. And she's got a couple great albums. I know she just came out with a new one. We're going to talk about that. She was just on the cover of Downbeat, I believe, in May. And let me see if I get all my facts straight. I know that you were also a Critics poll rising star for many years. And you've played with a ton of people. You have your own thing. And you're still alive. How are you doing?
Still alive.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here with you guys talking and seeing you over. I mean, I know nobody's going to be able to actually see us, but I can see you and that's really nice. We're virtually hanging out, which is basically what we do nowadays.
Right.
It's a very strange new world that we're living in. But it's nice to be able to talk to you guys.
Yeah, you too. And so we can start this out by talking about your new record, which you clearly timed perfectly with the release of this virus.
Oh yeah, me and Corona, we were in cahoots.
I know that because I had talked to Lydia, beforehand. Once you guys decided to go right on schedule and release it right in the beginning of this thing, and I think that's a strong decision. I mean, when are you going to do it if you don't do it now, right?
I gave it, a little bit of a thought, like a 2-second thought, whether I wanted to postpone the release or not. But this entire, the whole process of putting together this record, raising the money for it, recording it, post-production, publicity, I mean... The entire arc of the life of this album has lasted so long for me already that the idea of delaying it for one more thing, it was something that I considered for 2 seconds. And then I realized, no, I just have to get it out. And actually, the silver lining is that even though it came out right at the beginning of the pandemic, it was released on March 27th. It was about 2 weeks after the New York City lockdown happened. So the silver lining is that I think people were home. And at that point, 2 weeks in, they had already done all of their relaxing and being off tour. And then they were ready for content at that point.
Right. It was probably the best time. I mean, now it's like, it's kind of in the middle of this weird squeamish time, where people are kind of frustrated and depressed.
Yeah.
I think right then it was a good time.
It was a good time and nobody had screen fatigue yet. Everybody was kind of looking for material to listen to, comment on. And the cool thing is the amount of feedback that I got from people, which it was also the first time that I released a record and reached out to people individually by email, social media, not just in email blasts, but I sent individual messages to hundreds of people saying, this is the project, please give it a listen, post about it if you can, you know, and it was amazing to see how many people were actually willing to help me promote it on social media, probably just because everybody wanted to connect at that point. So that was great. People really gave it a listen. People listened and people commented. People contributed to helping me promote it. And I really do think from the personal messages that I got from people all over the world that it meant something to them, which was important. I mean, pandemic or not, I wanted to make an impact with the message of the record. And so I think that for a lot of people, they received that message, which was great.
Well, plus, like, as an artist, I don't know, maybe you'd agree, when you have a project that you've been working on and stuff, like, you kind of want to just you want to release it, because otherwise I feel like it'll like stunt your growth, because you need to move on to the next thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you put all that creative energy into something. I mean, does that happen? Like, have you ever not released something and kind of felt weird about it, and then you don't do much after that? I don't know.
I mean, I've done that with writing. You know, there are tunes that I have in the vault that I just, you know, I'm like, ugh, you know, I'm never releasing that, but it's something that came out. And then sometimes, and actually one of the cases of that happened on this record, where I had been writing a tune for my dad for years. Nice. I mean, years. And I never felt like it was finished, even though it was finished. And then finally, I guess he and I, my dad and I, we had to reach some part of our relationship where I had something else to say about it. And it created an entire new section of the tune, which it could have been a different tune. You know, harmonically, it's different. The vibe is different, but it ended up being just a new section to add to this original idea. And, So I had started writing that tune, you know, like 2010, I mean, maybe.
That's just being in touch with like your own. I mean, because I hear stuff like that from visual artists sometimes, you know, because it's such a physical thing that they're doing. They don't even realize why they're doing it, and they can't finish it. And then, like, it'll just dawn on them one day what it actually is.
Yeah.
And then they'll be able to finish it and, like, have an emotional breakdown half the time. You know what I mean? But that's, that's true. I mean, art. I love that.
It just really, there was this feeling that I had that it just wasn't finished. It wasn't finished. It wasn't what I wanted it to be.
That's so cool.
It wasn't the full story. And then finally the story happened in life, and then I was able to finish the tune.
Do you show people songs that you're working on, or do you have to get to a certain point? Like, do you get input?
I get input. Antonio and I have like a show and tell kind of thing when we're working on new music, because we really trust each other's ears. So when we're in the middle of writing or arranging something or producing it and, you know, doing something with sounds on Pro Tools, and we'll usually kind of both go to our separate lairs and work, and then we'll have a moment come where back. Come into each other's offices and kind of listen to what we've each been working on, and then we make comments, and so we kind of have like a little workshopping unofficial thing that we do, which is cool. But like I was saying, with the delays of this record and the reason that I wanted to release it right now in the pandemic is, you know, I had a huge delay with this record. I mean, we recorded it in 2018, and I had hoped to release it in 2019. But I raised all of the money with one of those crowdfunding platforms. It was called Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, not Kickstarter. That was my first record. This one was called Pledge Music. Sure. And I don't know if you guys heard about what happened to Pledge Music, but basically it was a huge scandal where the money from thousands of artists of campaigns was stolen.
Sure. Was it like a hack or was it inside?
No, it was inside. And basically the company was liquidated, and they're now, you know, being tried in the insolvency court in the UK. I mean, it was a whole thing.
But basically, it's impossible to get that money back. Exactly. It's like Bernie Madoff.
Exactly. So anybody that gets any kind of money will probably be creditors, you know, who were investing in the company in the beginning, but you know, as far as artists getting the monies from their campaigns,
you got your, you did get your money from that, right?
No, never got the money.
You didn't get any of
it?
But
the thing is that I had timed it so that I would get the money right as I was recording it. So the record went ahead and I basically spent my, you know, spent a good chunk of my savings to pay everybody. And then, but then I had no money for publicity. I had no money for, I mean, it was just, I was at a standstill.
See, I didn't know that. I should have known that. That's because that's one of those news stories that it passed me by somehow. But there's a certain kind of evil that only exists preying on musicians. It's just like, it's like the worst, you know what I mean? Like, you're going to kick people that, you know, don't have the money that the Wall Street people have or that the corporate people have. You're just going to kill the artists. Let's just steal from them, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, there hasn't been any kind of resolution in terms of what happened with Pledge Music. I know that they started as a British company that then had a sister company in the States, and they initially, they really wanted to support musicians in the beginning. And I think what happened is that they got too big too fast, hired too many people, and they couldn't afford it. And so what they started to do was dip into the campaign money to pay for all the things that they couldn't pay for. And then they got themselves into a horrible,
into a
mess.
Pyramid,
Adam, I was just thinking how she's like the best example ever of what we talked about on a past podcast about, like, you have to pay your cats. Like, I think that's so amazing that you went through all that and you still did what you could do to, like, to pay. You know what I mean? Like,
that's, I mean,
because that's a hell of a good excuse. Like, my money's gone.
We have this whole
you know?
podcast about being a good band leader, and that, you know, the first thing you have to understand is you have to pay the cats. Like, even if you don't get paid, like, and if you don't, they're not going to work for you. And it's not always, it's not that they don't like you. It's just business sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone needs to make a living. And you know that, and we know that.
And, exactly. And not only that, but when, so the record came out in March, and, you know, I had about 300 Pledge Music donors who paid for things that I now couldn't deliver. So basically what I did was from the time that I found out about, first they said they were going to file for bankruptcy, and then the bankruptcy never happened, and then they ended up liquidating the company. I mean, I was basically sending all of my supporters updates on what was happening. And I said, you know, I will do everything in my power to send you as much as I can from what you paid for. And basically then the pandemic hit. And we were all out of work. Post offices were closed. You know, I mean, all this stuff was happening. I also live in Queens, which was, I live in Jackson Heights in Queens, which was basically the worst hit neighborhood in New York City. And, so we're, you know, 5 minute walk from Elmhurst Hospital, which was just a disaster. I mean, we had the beginning of the pandemic. It was, you know, sirens all day long, every day. It was unbelievable. So I then sent another email to everybody basically saying, I'm so sorry. Not only did money get stolen, but now the pandemic, and I am so sorry. I'm going to have to delay sending you all of these things. But then in July, once everything was kind of safe again and New York had opened up, I ordered the t-shirts. I got the CDs printed, and I sent almost 300 packages all around the world on my own dime to send to everybody that supported me, because even if I didn't get the money, they still paid that money to support me. And so I felt like it was an honorable thing to do, to send them everything they paid for.
And all this while you were doing all that other stuff,
which
I'm still just
which Jake, like, knows all about.
So all this is going on, and you're like, I want to raise money to help other musicians, even though I just got, you know, kicked in the head with all this stuff.
Oh man!
I mean, I think I don't know. That's so New York musician like awesomeness.
I want to get into that that festival you did with Jake, but I want to go back to your record, because my high school Croatian class, I think I learned Ona Mi Shi, right?
Wait.
You didn't have a
high school Croatian class. I love it.
All right, wait. All right.
Especially
in that wasn't an option. So, it wasn't.
And I went to a very alternative school. You definitely got an A. You got an A. You have this outstanding A.
But wait, that's the only. It's the only word I know in Croatian. So, you know, you have to give me a pass. I wasn't a good student, but I, you know. Anyway, so
you passed.
I know
you
it passed. Means she, it and does. I know that it's also a very powerful record for you. And I think that why it was so important, right? Because this, the message was an empowering feminine record, right? About empowering women. Yeah. And do you want to talk about what this means to you? I mean, because I checked out the record and I think it's beautiful. I mean, stylistically, stylistically as well. I was just listening to it today, you know, in between my four-year-old jumping on my neck and twisting around and being my personal chiropractor.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. It's cool. It had a lot, you have all these great kind of vocal group things in there, as well as some very, very interesting rhythmic ideas with Antonio, and I think Matt Brewer was on it as well. Mm-hmm. And you have Regina Carter and all these really interesting eclectic things happening at the same time. I believe that there was also some Croatian in there, or is it
different? Absolutely. On the title track, there's mm-hmm. I had this incredible vocal, all-female Balkan choir named the Rosa Vocal Group come in, and they sang Croatian lyrics that I wrote for the title track.
Are they in New York?
They're in New York, yeah.
That's
and they're
dope.
Actually not a Croatian choir. They're, right. I found them through a Croatian vocalist friend of mine who lives in New York and who's part of the choir. But she had met all of these girls that graduated from Berkeley. And one of them is a Serbian girl who Amazing. Started the group. And the entire idea, like the mission statement of their group, is to revive Serbian folk songs that were never written down. And so Serbian and Croatian is basically the same language. We're next door neighbors. We just have a different alphabet. You know, they read Cyrillic. Okay. We read the Latin alphabet.
Yeah, that's what I learned in my class.
Yeah. But but basically we were all part of Yugoslavia at one point. And so I went to my Croatian friend, Astrid. It was her CD release party at Carnegie Hall, actually, a few years ago.
Oh, that's cool. Just a party over there.
Just nonchalantly, you know. And she had the Rosa Vocal Group come up as a guest because she had them on her record. And when I heard, and I was in the midst of like developing the idea of this record, and it still hadn't even come to me yet, the whole thing. I had written a few tunes. I was working on it, and I had this thing in my head of wanting like a village of women, like a rallying cry from these women, basically to signify or represent the women in my family, the cross-cultural, you know, generational thing of, you know, women, immigrant women that have come in my family that, you know, started in Croatia and the former Yugoslavia, escaped communism, came to the States, learned English, became American, you know, and all of these stories of the women in my family that I've heard, you know, from the time I was really, really little, and all the struggles and the things they went through, not only as women, but as immigrants and different points in history, the struggles that they had to deal with. So, I mean, I just had this thing in my head, and then I went to this show and I heard this group and I just flipped out. I said, man, that's the sound. That's what I've been looking for. And so I just reached out to them and I sent them the then sequence of the tune, because I do all my sequences on GarageBand, and I just play in all the instruments and then I sang in all the background vocals. And so, you know, it's kind of a good representation of what the tune could be, and sent it to them and they loved it. And that's the title track, Ona. And I mean, it's, you know, basically the Croatian, the lyrics of that tune are in English and in Croatian. So I have this choir singing in Croatian, and then I have four women singing an English choir, and that's Nicole Zoraitis, Sarah Charles, Claudia Acuna, and Sofia Rey. And they sing the English lyrics, and it's basically the two voice, the two female voices in my life, which are my grandmother with whom I speak Croatian and my mother with whom I speak English. And so it's like these two voices who have permeated my being and just taught me everything and also gone through everything that they went through in order for me, a first generation American, to feel as free as I do about being a woman and about, you know, being who I am.
Yeah, right.
But that was kind of the lead into this record. And it wasn't actually the first tune that I recorded. The first tune that I composed. The first tune that I composed was the second tune on the record, which is called The Resistance. And then that is one that kind of was the jumping off point for the entire project. And that was written really, really quickly and in an intense frenzy when I came back from the Women's March in 2017. And that was just such an impactful experience for me. And it changed me. And it really made me think about the fact that as an artist, you know, I can no longer use my platform just for entertainment. Right. You know, as much as I love music that's happy and nice and, you know, easygoing, the art that I want to look back on my life and see is art that makes a difference.
I think that's the one thing I maybe have always disliked about the States and could never really understand it until I met more people from different places. But like, I feel like the United States on a world stage is maybe one of the only places where art is just like, it's mostly just entertainment. And I think like you breaking that mold is a huge start to something that can change that. Cause you talk to people from other countries, especially like in the field of like dance choreography and all this stuff. And you look at the history of music and art, it's always a reaction and it always has to do with like freedom and release. It's not usually entertainment. It means way more than that. So,
I mean, it depends what kind of crisis is going on though.
Yeah. You know? But it's just cool to hear you say that. I mean, like
back in the 60s, there was a lot of anti-war protests. There was, and now we're seeing a lot of Black Lives Matter protests in sports and in music. And I think it's necessary. And if people are listening and you have an audience, you have to tell them, you know.
Yeah. I mean, people are really speaking out and singing out and, you know, using their art forms as platforms of change, which is incredible. And the thing is, you know, I feel like artists are historians in a way, because no matter what art form you choose to express yourself in, whether it's in the visual arts, in music, in dance, in theater, you know, basically the art that comes out of a generation, when you look back on history, it shows you what was happening during that point in history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really feel like we have a responsibility to use that platform.
That's the real talent too, is how you can spark an emotion through that. Like I remember right after 9/11, they did a lot of like performances and stuff like that. And there was one on like NBC or something. It was like a huge thing. Mm-hmm. And Sting played Fragile. Mm-hmm. And, I'll never forget, I was sitting in the living room with my parents and, you know, a couple of brothers and sisters, and they went to commercial break and it was like super silent. And my father was just sitting there and he just goes, how do you guys know how to just like do that? Like, how did Sting know how to just drive that into my heart? I'm like, because that's the talent of a musician and an artist. They can spark that emotion. He was like blown away. I was blown away that he felt it at that level, because we'd never discuss anything like that. Wow. But that like blew my mind. Like that's
the power, you know, of music.
Yeah.
You know, it's so powerful. And
yeah, I mean, you could say the same words, it's not going to have the same effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like anesthesia to get the tooth out. Sometimes you got to like numb it up, you know, get some good music going and then get the message in there.
There you go.
Eject a rotten tooth.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
We have some rotten tooths around here. So.
there's a lot of rotten teeth right now.
There's a lot of rotten teeth.
Yeah, nobody's been to the dentist in quite a while.
I have not. No, and my dentist is getting very, very antsy. He's, yeah, he keeps texting. He's like, we're open. We're open. I said, you know, for a cleaning, I'm good. You know,
yeah, I don't really want anybody in my mouth right now.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. It's like, you know, if this side of my face swells up about that much, I don't know. I'll see if I can poke it with something. I don't know. We'll see.
Oh,
Self-dentistry.
Yeah.
It's like the haircuts like right now.
The marathon man.
Oh, yeah. I've given Antonio two haircuts now.
Nice.
He's easy. He just buzz it, right?
No. His hair's so long now. You guys haven't even seen. He just decided, all right, I'm just going to let it grow. And he has super curly hair, which is surprising. He has these curly locks. And he's just let it grow, and then he shaved his beard.
So he needs product now and everything?
He's got to use product now.
Yeah, you got to use it.
And he shaved his beard for the first time since like 1998.
Oh, man. Is he super high maintenance when you try to give him a cut?
No, I mean, he's just kind of like, you know, don't cut too much. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. He's got a good attitude. I mean, my hair was absolutely insane until I just cut it. But I was like, you know, everywhere. And I just cut my son's hair and, you know, we just did it outside. I did the best I could. It looks good. Yes. I'm good at it.
Man, I mean, cutting a four-year-old's hair by yourself, that's got to be terrifying.
Well, my wife was here. You know, we
tend to. But holding him down? Like, all right, I'll cut.
No, you see, what you do is you don't allow
Benadryl. That's what you do. No, I'm just kidding.
Jesus.
No, hard drugs. Not Benadryl. No.
He's not a drummer. You don't have to do
Oxy.
That.
No. All right, wait. I'm going to cut that out because
okay, I'm sorry.
DYFS will be at my house. I'll be like taking my child. No, what you do is we don't let him do screen time. So, I mean, a lot. Like, he does a little TV, so he gets super psyched. So, if I put, like, a little video in front of him, and he's like, you know, he turns into Zombaby.
I mean, props to you and your wife for not letting screen time rule your life with your
son. He has
no
iPad, none of that stuff, you know?
That's amazing.
I mean, come on, man. He's got plenty of time to do that later.
Mm-hmm.
He has to be a like creative kid, you know. We go outside and make things out of sticks and build and draw. I mean, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
That's how you get a creative brain. You don't get it by, you know, this.
It's true.
Is his first app going to be J-Date?
What are you talking about? He's four. It's so inappropriate. So inappropriate.
I can't believe he's already four. Oh my God, Jesus.
Yeah, he's ruling me. He's into all kinds of stuff. But anyway, let's move on to something completely different. So you just did this crazy festival that was online, and I know Jake had a lot to do with helping with the graphics and some other things.
Well, we did actually.
We did. Oh, that's right, because
they fired you.
Yeah. So
I wouldn't keep that guy for the third one. Yeah. Jake's the worst.
No, Jake is...
No, it was in between. They were just like, oh, we're just going to do this real quick. I'm like, what?
Yeah, I mean, we are three organizers who lost our minds. No, I mean, we're... Basically, what happened is that in the very, very beginning of the pandemic, when all of our social media feeds started seeing canceled, 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 no tour, no gig, no this, no that. This, one of our organizers, Sarintip, a great singer here in New York City, she said, I'm going to start a personal GoFundMe for my friends for my birthday. That's going to be my birthday thing. I'm going to ask people to donate to this personal GoFundMe, and I'm going to try to help my friends who are losing all their gigs. And then her friend Owen Broder, who is our third organizer, he saw her initiative, her personal GoFundMe, and he got in touch with her and said, hey, what if we made this into an online festival? I have this idea to do something called Live from Our Living Rooms, but I don't know how to do it. And she said, that sounds awesome. Let's call my friend Tana, who has some great ideas, and let's see where we can go with this. And then we basically all started. I mean, we put the first thing together in less than 3 weeks. It was just a really quick turnaround. And basically what I brought to the table was that I suggested that if we were going to solicit, you know, if we were going to ask for donations from people, a really great incentive for people to donate is to make them tax deductible donations. So I contacted a friend of mine here in the city who has a nonprofit. This nonprofit, I've done a lot of shows for. It has to do with music and bringing music, you know, all kinds of music into these beautiful, small, intimate salon settings. Oh, and he does a lot of educational work and It's called Music Talks. And I approached him and said, would you be, you know, willing or interested in being our fiscal sponsor, basically our nonprofit partner for this one festival? And we'll have a new GoFundMe under Music Talks, which, you know, through which we'll solicit tax deductible donations. And then at the end, you as Music Talks can issue the grants from the money that we've raised. And he said yes. So basically we had all of this set in motion. We had this idea that we were going to raise money, and at the end of raising all this money, we would give $500 grants to struggling New York City-based musicians. So we started with New York because that's where we all live and all, you know, the scene that we love. And then, you know, the question was, all right, who do we reach out to for this 1 week festival?
And are you sure the question wasn't who don't we reach out for?
Yeah.
It seems like you guys got everyone.
I mean, it was, the thing is that we,
yeah, I mean, like everybody's free. That's the problem.
Well, I mean, number one, there were a lot of people that were free, but number two, we knew that, you know, mostly anybody who is a successful musician has come through New York at one point or another and sure. loves New York City. And so we, you know, there were all of these things popping up where, you know, different organizations were doing different kinds of fundraisers for musicians all around the country, but there was not one that was very specifically for New York. And New York is the scene that we love. It's the scene that we're part of. And so it was actually Antonio's idea. Like, why don't we just reach out to some of the heavies? You know, you know them, they love you. You know, I'm sure if they don't want to be involved, they'll tell you that they're not interested. And if they do, you know, great. And so we reached out to the heavies and the response. I mean, that's been the most amazing part of this for me personally, just to see how really incredibly well-known, well-established musicians didn't give it a second thought. It was, yeah, sure, of course I'll do something. You know, it was like, you know, Chick Corea and Bill Frisell and Joe Lovano, Linda Oh, Becca Stevens, you know, it was just like this insane, yeah. Christian McBride and Melissa Walker, this insane group
good
of
people.
Unbelievable
and
musicians.
Free.
And they were free.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's like if you're a good person and you're busy, you don't always have the time
exactly.
to be helping. But
yeah.
if you're cool, mm-hmm. and those people are all cool people.
Yeah.
It's great.
And they all said yes. And then we basically, from all of that, what we wanted to do was create obviously a festival that had some heavier names so that we could get the publicity, but we also wanted to infuse that programming with some emerging artists and with some educational stuff, because we also have so many friends that had kids that were home from school and were just going bananas. So
yes.
we basically did a 7-day festival with 4 events a day. There was a morning children's show, an afternoon masterclass or interdisciplinary show, and then 2 evening performances for 7 days. And we raised 60 grand.
Jesus.
Man, that's great.
It was
actually
unbelievable.
I never asked, actually.
Yeah,
never...
we raised 60 grand. And it was just crazy, really, really crazy. And so what we ended up doing was, and everybody played for free. Everybody donated their time. Some of them, most of them had never done live streaming before. And a lot of them also didn't have recording gear at home. You know, this was Bill Frisell playing guitar through his iMac, you know,
right.
video camera and microphone.
Something you want to stop. I remember Adam Rogers.
I was that masterclass will go down in history as like the most
so
amazing
good.
Hang with Adam Rogers. So, you know,
he's got just a good setup there.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was, you know, it was just it was a really heartwarming experience to see how many people came to the aid of those in need. And what ended up happening is that we ended up giving out, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I think it was 67 grants. And we ended up giving, in most cases, almost double what we had originally planned to give.
Which is amazing.
Which was great.
The, the DC thing happened, were you guys like consultants on that? Did they pull you into that one?
Basically, once our first go around was that we saw all of our friends were getting canceled, their gigs, their tours.
Yep.
And then the second thing we started to see were all these festivals were getting canceled. So we said, why don't we just send out a couple of proposals and say, we have this platform. We figured out how to do these shows.
Yeah, it works.
We can present your festival. So we sent it out to a few different festivals, and a few of them got back to us. And the DC Jazz Fest actually said, well, we have our summer session coming up and we would love to do something. That's and so we partnered with the DC Jazz Festival to present their DC Jazz Fest from home, which was a 9-day event, 3 events a day. And it was, you know, basically the idea there was to extend our help to our neighbors in DC and help the DC area musicians. So we did everything under the nonprofit of the DC Jazz Festival. And they had their GoFundMe, and we helped, you know, promote the shows. And of course, Jake did a lot of the, well, actually, no, Jake, you did.
I didn't do anything.
You
did, for that one.
Yeah. First and third. Jake for the first and the third series that we did just helped us so much with content and creating.
Did you try for Detroit at all? Did they do
anything? We didn't actually. Detroit, we didn't have any connection there. So we just reached out to people that we knew personally.
Yep.
And Owen had this connection with DC Jazz Fest as his parents live in DC, and that's just kind of a home for him. So,
but
then, you know, all the while we knew we wanted to do another live from our, you know, specifically live from our living rooms series. And we wanted to make it more of, instead of being a festival, we wanted it to be more education based, because we also realized that, you know, people want to learn. They have the time now. They want to spend an hour on Zoom with their musical heroes and hang and ask questions, do webinars and things like that. And we also wanted to help out the musician community that we felt was probably freaking out, as we all were, as, you know, musician organizers with no gigs in sight, no plans for touring, no idea how we're going to navigate this new world. So we came up with a 12-day creative summit, we called it. And the idea was to raise a bunch of money in order to give a second round of grants. Mm-hmm. But also pay musicians to participate. So, you know, this far into the pandemic, we wanted to set the precedent that music should not be free, and people should not play for free, and people should not be putting up content for free, and, you know, all of this stuff.
That stuff is more obvious now than ever, right? It's like when people were getting paid, everyone was just putting their stuff up for free.
Yeah, exactly.
But now it's like, come on, man.
Yeah. So, and the thing is that we knew that even the heavy people, again, that we reached out to, and we made it a point to not do any repeats from the first festival. So we wanted to get all new people. We, as organizers, decided that, it wouldn't be correct for us to also perform in this second, you know, or third series. We wanted to make sure that, you know, we helped the community, and we wanted to show that this was not an excuse to, you know, give us as organizers a gig. And so basically we proceeded to do this insanely ambitious 12-day creative summit, which basically we contracted over 120 artists. I mean,
it was a university. You guys made a university. It was a school.
It was crazy.
Straight up.
It's completely bonkers. It was a school, and Jake helped put together all of the, you know, the programs and the content and schedule.
He doesn't sleep anyway. He's an narcoleptic.
I mean, he obviously doesn't sleep.
I was looking at the names. I'm like, this is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the names were incredible. And basically, we had, you know, each day we had up to 9 simultaneous Zoom workshops happening. We had webinars in the afternoon, and we had concerts at night.
Did you record them too?
We recorded them, and we kept them up as replays for a total of 2 weeks at the, you know, basically at the discretion of each artist, so that each replay could, you know, basically get more revenue.
Great.
But then after those 2.5 weeks, we took everything down, just to respect the artist, because the artist got, you know, their fee from that revenue up to that point. And we felt that it was not fair to keep the content up, and, you know.
Plus, it just makes it what it was, special.
Yeah, it's special. And we, I mean, we have everything archived. So, you know, we'll see what we may do with that in the future, you know, with permission of some of the artists. So we're kind of working on that. But basically, over the course of these three series since April, we've raised over 140 grand for musicians.
It's crazy.
It's amazing.
Which is amazing. So, and then this third one, we were able to pay the musicians to participate. And now we're basically organizing the next round of grants. So from the money that we raised for the, this last go around, whatever's left after paying all of the musicians that participated, and some actually donated their revenue completely, which was also an amazing thing to see. Just, you know, how the community came together and supported everybody.
What was, what was like the, like, testimonial kind of response from, like, a student perspective of people watch? Did you get enough data with stuff like that?
So, well, maybe the analytics were actually very interesting, just from an analytics standpoint, going from our April festival to now.
You mean on views and attendance and all that?
Yeah, views and attendance. Number one, our first festival was completely free. So the minute we put up a paywall, you could see the difference there. So, you know, basically about 20% of people that landed on our page would actually pay for the events, which was very interesting.
Because you guys were selling
pretty
out.
Good.
I mean, we sold out a lot of things. One. You know, so there were a few different price points. So we had workshops that were exclusive events. So it wasn't like, you know, on Zoom, you can have a call with up to 100 participants. But we wanted to make sure that everybody was on one screen, got enough time with the person that they were paying, you know, good money to see. Especially now when a lot of people are out of work. And, you know, we just wanted to make it accessible to everybody, but also worthwhile for the musicians and fair. Yeah. So it was, you know, workshops were up to 25 people, I believe, and they were $30 to $40 a piece for an hour, you know, and 15-minute workshop. And the webinars and performances, which were done on our streaming site, those were a base donation of $3 each. And if people wanted to donate more, they could. And then we also offered packages, you know, because we're live from our living rooms, you could become a couch surfer. And we have these different price points of basically donation, couch surfer privileges.
Well, the graphics were cool. Like, the graphic designer made some cool, like, I still love that yellow and black look. Like, you guys could probably sell, you know, some swag and, like, because it's a memory too. I mean, it's, like, when this stuff's all gone and said and done, and we're doing whatever we're doing in the future, like, it, I don't know, it's a special time. It might be bad, but, like, I don't know, this whole year has been pretty special to me, you know. Like, I think it's worth keeping that memory. But
it is, and, you know, we've been talking about it a lot, because we have a guidebook now. It's called The Motivated Musician, where we do this monthly thing, and we're just trying to help people out. And a lot of what we talk about now is, you know, keeping it together mentally, keeping your focus, and how to be an entrepreneur. And and it's one of the big things I'm talking about this next edition, is that it's important, or more important now than ever, to be an entrepreneur, to be this creative, free thinking, intelligent human that we're all supposed to be as musicians. Like, why we're supposed to be these radical thinkers, right? Like, let's not stick to the book here, you know, let's not just stick to the old streams of income. And because when this boils over, or when it blows over, boils over is absolutely the wrong metaphor. When it blows over, it's not going to be really that over. You know, I mean, what if COVID comes back in the winter, or or there's another COVID, the return of COVID, you know, COVID 20, you know what I mean? Like, whatever it is. I mean, And it might be something that's not viral, but the point is, we need to have ways as musicians to make money in this kind of scuba diving, breathing underwater scenario that we don't love, but we have to embrace.
Yeah.
You know? And I think you're doing a great job.
I mean, that's been hard. You know, the Live From Our Living Rooms project was, it was a saving grace for me, because, you know, And Jake, you mentioned something about this, you know, kind of related to the tunes. And do you ever have something in the vault and you don't, you know, you want to move on or you don't want to move on? I mean, basically, that's what I considered my record. You know, I was in a touring year. I was supposed to be out on the road constantly this year and promoting this record that I worked so hard over so many years to get out. And so I still feel like that record is this unfinished story that I need to finish. And so it's been really difficult for me to mentally pluck myself out of that and let go of that project and start something new. So creatively speaking, musically speaking, I haven't created anything new. I haven't written anything new. I've been very kind of dry creatively. Because I guess it's a mix of fear. It's a mix of not having outside stimuli. I mean, you know, we're as artists, we're kind of these sponges that soak up what's happening outside of us. And then we kind of, you know, we're these prisms and we just kind of.
And what's outside of us right now is shit.
Yeah. So where we used to have all this outside stimuli, now we're just inside. We're not playing music. We're not playing with people. You know, it's a very different way to experience life, experience music, and experience ourselves. So the fact that I was able to use my creative mind in a different way by helping to create this project, this Live From Our Living Rooms thing, that saved me. You know, I mean, it was something that I felt a purpose for. You know, I felt like I had a purpose. And I felt like I could be creative even if it wasn't writing music and performing music. And I did do a bunch of the live streams. I mean, Antonio and I did a couple of, you know, duo shows. Mm-hmm. I've done a couple of solo shows with my looping pedals. And that has actually given birth to a new idea, a socially distanced idea for going on the road with my own record and not having to tour with a band. I'm basically developing my solo show so that I can go on the road by myself and have it be cheaper. And
I've seen the audience react. The last time I saw you was at the convention.
That's awesome.
And that place was packed when you were on stage. People were freaking out.
And I've seen seen some of the stuff you've done with Sonica as well. And also even on your new record, you integrate electronics. And it's very, it's a very organic mix. It doesn't sound foreign. You figured out how to integrate it into your vocabulary and your being. And that's very, very cool.
Thanks. I mean, I've been trying, you know, the electronics kind of came into the picture a few years ago. And just learning more and more about what the machines could do kind of informed how I write the music too, because I now know that, you know, this kind of thing is possible live. So I'm going to write the tune to adhere to what the device can do.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, I think I saw maybe 2017 JVC Newport. You played with Migration.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is going to be crazy. And you went out and you basically were an instrument of vocals. But like, I feel like your style has now fully blossomed into like, you can be a singer, you can be a vocalist, you could be like an instrument that's building parts. And I think that's why your looping stuff is so cool. But do you have any advice with singers to sort of be brave and go out and don't just put yourself in a corner of I have to sing lyrics and be a melody, blah blah blah? Like, how did that come around for you?
I mean, it started, I mean, I basically developed this kind of mission as a singer to become, you know, a lyrical and an experimental instrument. Yep. So basically we have as singers the ability to use our voice with or without lyrics. And I find that really fascinating. The fact that we can imitate other instruments. Not that we sound like those other instruments, but we can develop a sound of our own with thinking about other instruments and not using lyrics.
Like scat, do you think?
It totally came from scat. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I was in college, the thing that kind of started this roller coaster of this whole, like, using the voice as an experimental instrument was that I learned very quickly in music school that singers are not popular. You know, the minute the singer enters the room, it's like, wah, wah, let's play a ballad. Okay. Yeah. You know, and I was pissed. I was, you know, I'm here to learn. I'm here to, you know, get my ass handed to me. I want to improvise. You know, basically, I witnessed, at least in music school, that there was, you know, this very apparent divide between instrumentalist and vocalist. And I saw that the vocalist would be a part of the band for the head of the tune, sing the lyrics, and then would step to the side when all the music would happen.
Yep.
And I was pissed. I was like, that's what I want to be a part of. Yeah. You know, jazz is about improv. Jazz is about stretching. Jazz is about listening to each other. And I can't really interact as much singing the lyrics to a tune, even though there's a lot of interaction there. Yeah. But I can't interact in the same way as when I'm soloing and doing something on the spot with the rest of the band giving me all this musical information at the same time. And so I kind of made it a point while I was a student to put myself in really uncomfortable situations. And I was the first vocalist in a lot of instrumental ensembles that would just show up for the audition at the beginning of the semester. And they would say, I'm sorry, you're in the wrong room. You know, standards ensemble is down the hall. And I was like, no, if it's okay with you, I'd really like to audition. Yeah. And man, I sucked. I mean, I was just, you know, I was not, you know, so there was actually one particular ensemble that I was a part of in college that I was one of those where I walked into the room and they're like, are you in the right room? And then I auditioned to be in it and I got in, and it was an ensemble with Reggie Workman.
Nice.
And oh, you went to the new school, right?
I went to the new school, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember the first few weeks of that semester, you know, we were doing standards, but we were also, he was kind of allowing us to bring in some original music and we would work through it, which was really cool. And, everybody was soloing and, you know, but he was really like digging into everyone. Like he would not rip them apart, but he would give them some pretty structural criticism after they would solo. And like, this is what you need to focus on. This is what you're lacking. Da, da, da. And with me in the beginning, it was like, really nice. Great job. You know, and then I actually stayed after one class and I talked to him and I said, Reggie, I really appreciate that you, you know, let me into this ensemble. But I would really like for you to tell me the truth about my soloing because I really want to get better. And, you know, and I'm not going to cry. Because
it's not a gimmick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I'm doing this shit.
I mean,
like,
I really want to get better. So I want you to dig into me like you're digging into the guys. And he's like, All right, I got you. You know, and then from then on, it was different. And he really helped me a lot just in developing and listening and just kind of developing a story. But then a lot of my schooling of using my voice as a non-lyrical instrument came after school, you know, when I started getting gigs as a side woman. And especially when I started playing with Antonio's band. Because all of those guys are heavy. I mean, when I started playing with them and seeing how, you know, they were on point 200% of their game every night, no matter whether they were jet lagged or tired or hungry or in a bad mood. I mean, the music, totally. Like, you know, the gig is church. That's like, you are on. And they just killed it. And I really learned a lot from being, you know, in the middle of all of that and seeing how it was night after night and just seeing the places that they would reach with each other and how everybody was opening their ears to each other. And that's also a very different experience playing in a band that's been together for a while, you know, just having
that
synergy.
At that point,
synergy.
Was it Seamus, Blake, and those guys at that point?
Yeah. Right. So Seamus, Matt Brewer, Antonio, and John Escreet. Mm-hmm. And then later it ended up being Chase Baird took Seamus's place.
I'll never
take Seamus's place, but you know what I mean. But Seamus went on to do more solo stuff and it was just like a, you know, an understanding that he and Antonio had. And Chase is incredible. So basically learning to be on the road with them and just kind of reach for things in myself that I didn't know were, you know, were there. And also being married to Antonio and having a different perspective of rhythm in my life. So, you know, what I started to do was basically go through a lot of his old drum books and create vocal exercises from the drum books. So like, I know a lot of, people know the famous syncopation. You guys know this book, right?
Oh yeah. I do because I've done a lot of drum videos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So syncopation for the modern drummer.
That's great for every instrument. It's a great way to learn instrument. How to read too.
Yeah, totally. It's great. And so, but for me, you know, as a vocalist, I get, or just as a person, I get really overwhelmed very easily. So when I, and studying soloing is not something that is very easy to do when you're a singer, because there's not a lot of real material that exists out there to teach you to solo like an instrumentalist. You know, there are some really good books like the How to Improvise, Hal Crook, which is for every instrument. There's David Berkman has a great book for singers specifically. You know, there is some material out there.
Otherwise, but you're just getting your face blown off by like Ella. You're like, oh my God.
But even then, like, even then, you know, Ella has her thing and Sarah has her thing. But, you know, there's no explanation for how they got there. You know, how did they do that?
Because often people will be like a pianist and then they can just sing what they're playing or something like that. And but it's like if you're not a virtuoso on another instrument, how do you get there? Like with your voice.
And nowadays, the music is also really different because, you know, it's not always swing. It's not always bebop. It's, you know, blending of genres, learning how to create tension and release. Really, you know, I wanted to really, and I'm still struggling within myself to try to figure out ways to tell a story without using lyrics. So how do you tell a story with a solo? How do you develop something and have a beginning, a middle, and an end? Not overspeak, not, you know, how do I make sure that it's not a, you know, monologue, that it's a dialogue between the band and me? You know, it's...
Well, that's the thing too. Like when you were mentioning school, I feel like this is important for, like, I think more people should do what you're doing because just the presence of you there saying to a group of people, like, break the mold of we play the head, she does the lyrics, and then we get to just like solo over change. Like that is a very immature way to look at the jazz language. And
it's a very academic way. It happens so much in school.
So I think that's a great way to like break the mold, like to have a presence of a singer that's just not going to walk away when the head's done. You know what I mean? Like that's, I don't know. That's cool.
It's your fighting spirit. You know, you got to be a fighter.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and also it's kind of, there is the whole woman aspect to it also when you're, you know, young and you're expected just be, you know, the pretty singer to come and, you know, decorate the band a little bit and then you leave and all the cool shit happens. You know?
Yeah. That way and, I thought it needs to end.
It's totally lame.
Exactly. And so, but also I realized really early on that I, you know, if I wanted to be an equal part of any band, just like any other instrumentalist, I have to shed like other instrumentalists too. And that's the kind of practice that I'm lacking in terms of how I learned to do it. Because I just kind of taught myself, you know, I went through the drum books and I would create vocal exercises from drum books and I would, you know, do different things with harmony. But that's doing it.
You're writing the curriculum now. Like maybe you're the one.
So that's, I mean, I've been thinking about it.
Yeah.
I mean, since we got no gigs for the next year, I mean, maybe I'm going to write a book. I don't know.
Everyone's got different things. You know, I know that you're friends with Joe Lowry as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did a great masterclass with her and she made this really cool exercise where she would go through standards in order to learn the changes and sing just a certain interval on every one of the changes. And it was really cool because it's really, really difficult to
it's
do.
So
but she
difficult.
Would be like, I'm just going to sing like the ninth. So if it's a sharp nine or if it's a regular nine, like on every chord as you go through it. And that's the stuff that if you didn't make up that exercise, it's not out there.
Yeah.
Like no one's going to show you that.
Yeah.
You just have to be like, what am I weak at?
Yeah.
What am I weak at? What do I want? Or what do I want to get better at? And how can I do that?
Yeah.
And that's why, and I think that's what's important about everything right now with music is that we have a crisis with work. And we also, after the crisis is hopefully dissipated slightly. We're always going to have small things that we're working on, or big things, and we have to figure out how to get through them. And being creative and finding a way to deal with things and get better is great. And your festival, and you know, you've done a lot of creative things.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the struggle with this pandemic situation, is that it feels like everything and nothing at the same time.
Yeah,
which is, I'm sure, something I think everyone that we all share. Like that, yeah. But you know, it's always...
That's definitely going around. Literally, my friend just, like, got her big break in television. She was all over billboards, LA.
Yeah.
And she couldn't leave the house. She did Conan O'Brien from, like, her room. You know what I mean? Like, so she's got this weird thing of, like, I did all this stuff, but it doesn't feel like it because I've been sitting in my house. Yeah. But don't let that carpet. Shit fool you.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, I've been working on stuff that, I mean, the weekend before the New York lockdown, we filmed my music video, which has being edited this whole time. So now it's ready, finally.
That's fun.
I mean, it was obviously delayed because of the pandemic and people got sick.
Definitely
and blah, blah, blah,
tell
blah.
Us about it. We'll blast it out there.
I will. Thanks. So, you know, and then I'm also doing a new thing where I've basically created from... You know, because the tunes on my record, we were talking about a lot of the odd time signature stuff before. And, you know, there's some challenging stuff in there. And I wanted to make it accessible to people. And so I've basically created these -1 demos where it's the whole band -1. So if you're a drummer and you want to learn how to play the tune That's in 11/8... Awesome. You can get the mastered version of that tune without the drums, and then that's you become cool. Antonio, and you get the chart and all this stuff. So
that's all I have to do to become Antonio?
Right, yeah!
So give me that shit right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so, I mean, I think the biggest thing in this pandemic is that everybody, you know, everybody always wanted to feel relevant.
Yeah.
And social media makes you feel so irrelevant.
Oh, yeah.
And now more than ever, people want to feel that relevance. You know, they're so out of touch. They're so locked down. They're so, you know, thirsty for music and for human connection. And, it's rough. It's rough for all of us. I mean, both Antonio and I have our major ups and downs, and we're just trying to work through it. You know,
you're a married couple and you're in quarantine.
And we haven't killed each other. We kind of love each other still.
You know what I'm saying? If you don't kill each other, you'd probably be together for at least a couple more years. Exactly. Before my audio crashes again, I want to say thanks so much for being on with us. And, you know, thanks for hanging. And it was great to see you.
Man,
and,
thanks for having me.
Jake, I do see him sometimes, but, I haven't seen you in a long time. I'm glad you're hanging in, and you and Antonio are still alive and still kicking it.
And
thanks for all the work you've been doing. It's amazing.
And thanks. Thanks for having me on. It's so good to see both of you. And I wanted to let you know that I know we had emailed in July right before the pandemic. I mean, right before the next series happened. And I was like, I'm going to do this video with Antonio. We're going to film something. Oh, yeah. And then after the summit, after the last series, I just like, I collapsed. Yeah, so
exhaustion.
Exhaustion. Exhaustion took its toll. But I'm definitely, now that I'm developing this solo looping program for my music, I think it would definitely would warrant a cool video. So
yeah, man. And for those of you that want to know, it was going to be, and it will be, a really, really cool video with super cool looping and drums and vocals and awesomeness that make this really cool rhythmic melodic bed of coolness. Is that adequate?
Sounds accurate.
A rhythmic bed of coolness. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I think that's what I'll use. All right. Thanks so much,
guys.
Donna,
it's so good to see you.
See you soon,
all right.
Hopefully.
Awesome. Take care, both of you.
See ya.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail. You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.